This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3.
And you're listening to Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the United States, and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 is located, or the east side of New Orleans, where WAMF 90.3 is housed, or Greenville, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org. A podcast will be available to the show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Professor Lisa Stolberg, who's an associate professor of the sociology of education at New York University, and she's written a very interesting and I think important book, LGBT Social Movements, that looks at the, well, I'm going to let Lisa Stolberg tell us what it really looks at, but I think you take a pretty good gulp at the whole history of how this has developed over the recent years. Lisa, welcome to Wade's World.
Thanks, Wade. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, give people a sense of what you tried to do in this book.
So I teach at New York University. I've been teaching here for about 15 or so years, and I teach a social movements class to undergraduates. And I started teaching the class in the sort of middle of the George W. Bush administration, or actually the beginning, and we talked a lot about how to make social change, and my students were really interested in becoming activists themselves, but they sort of looked around them in the early part of the new millennium and weren't quite sure how to do that. And so we talked a lot about learning from history, about how to think about change, how to develop a theory of change, how to develop strategies for change. And I think the movements around gender and sexual justice that I write about in this book, LGBTQ social movements, teach us a lot about social organizing of various ways. And one of the main themes of the book is that there are many ways to be an activist. And that's something that I've talked with my students about over and over again. I was a child of the 80s myself and kind of looked back wistfully on the 60s and thought that I had been born in the wrong time. But I learned, and through kind of talking with my students, I learned that there are many ways to be an activist. It doesn't always mean sort of marching and mass demonstrations in the streets. That can activism can take many forms, and that's one of the things that I write about and hopefully show in the book.
Well, certainly the codification of real rights for the LGBT community has to be one of the most significant social changes we've seen really in either of our lifetimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's
where
right.
We started, you know, I'm I guess, sort of that 60s generation. But from where we started then, and even where we started in the 80s, we've come a million miles. Not that we don't have a million more to go, but back then, the notion of some of the even the civil rights, marriage, this kind of thing, unheard of, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think starting in the 50s, we saw the federal government really crack down on just being gay, and McCarthy sort of tied his anti-communist agenda to an anti-gay agenda. We saw the federal government criminalizing homosexuality and same-sex practice, even actually up until this millennium. I remember teaching this class, the social movements class, and I was teaching it at the moment when the Supreme Court finally decriminalized sodomy in 2003. So this is not, we're not talking about a long time ago when even the most basic humanity and civil rights for LGBTQ people was on the table.
So when you talk about, and you referenced your class and the various ways that you can manifest, you know, activism, certainly there were mass protests, but this was not the civil rights movement of the as we saw in a racial sense, or even in the women's liberation movement. This was a different kind of movement in some places, wasn't it?
It was. I think there, depending on the time we're talking about, so one of the things we'll probably talk more about is the late 60s period and the Stonewall Rebellion, and the fact that there was a crime in New York and other places for gay and lesbian people to just congregate and to drink, and so gay bars were raided very frequently, and the Stonewall Bar, Stonewall Inn, was a gay bar in the West Village in New York that where patrons sort of rose up for one of the first times in history against this police repression, and that did kick off a social movement of the kind that we typically think of when we think about civil rights or women's rights, but there had been lots of smaller organizations founded for, by and for gay and lesbian people many years before Stonewall, and one of the things I write about in the book is that arts and literature and popular culture were always a form of mobilization and community building and resistance for LGBTQ people, that and that existed well before Stonewall from the late 1960s.
And was that force primarily within that community, or do you also think it impacted the wider community as well?
I think it impacted the wider community as well. I think depending on the time, I think before the late 1960s, the what was then just sort of considered the gay and lesbian community. We hadn't yet sort of developed a politics or identity around bisexuality or transgender identity. For these early gay and lesbian activists and organizers, they weren't out in their communities or their families or their workplaces for the most part. So the visibility wasn't there, which meant that the impact on the broader culture was much less. That started to change in the 1960s, and visibility became a huge part of the movement, and sort of breaking out of and breaking down the closet became a huge part of the movement starting in the late 1960s. So that move, I think, did mean that the movement could impact a broader culture and a broader public.
And where do you see the timeline starting to move forward in terms of a more rights-based and entitlement kind of program?
I think there were a couple of years after Stonewall that were quite radical, and the movement sort of was known as the gay liberation movement. There were a couple of years where a focus on rights wasn't really the primary aim of the movement, but I think fairly quickly in the early to mid-70s, the movement started to focus more on civil rights and on the law as a focus on for social change and on, if not assimilation, at least kind of opening up American mainstream institutions to gender and sexual minorities. So there was a more radical phase, I would say late 60s to early 70s, and by the mid-70s or so, the movement, the mainstream part of the movement, really began focusing on civil rights primarily.
Your book, and obviously history, you know, looks at this very carefully. The AIDS epidemic was also a huge factor that sort of interweaves much of that period as it moves towards the late 70s, 80s, et cetera, doesn't it?
Yeah, so we start to see the first cases of people presenting with AIDS symptoms in 1980, 1981. And one of the main things I write about in the book and one of the, my main themes and messages is that the federal government, again, really was a problem for many minority groups and oppressed minorities in this country. And the AIDS crisis really was a prime example of the federal government turning its back on and really framing gay men as less than human. Ronald Reagan, who was the president, of course, during this period, barely mentioned the word AIDS for the first 5 or 6 years of the epidemic and really failed to put the resources of the federal government behind any response to AIDS. And that was both a rallying cry for the movement and a way to sort of move the movement towards a focus not just on civil rights, but also on holding the government accountable in new ways, and also was a radicalizing force in the sense that many AIDS activists and then later LGBTQ activists really recognized the extent to which the federal government just saw them as less than human and was willing to just completely ignore, if not vilify them in this during this crisis.
Well, there were certainly politicians who overtly vilified, who saw this as sort of God's punishment for, this kind of lifestyle and behavior. And certainly, we didn't call states red and blue at that time, but certainly there were a lot of, political figures in more conservative communities who were, adamant, much in the same way that people said, African Americans would never come to their schools. They were very clear about how they saw the rights of, particularly at that point, as you point out, gays and lesbians, and saw AIDS as just sort of, collateral damage. That's what they deserved. It sounds horrific to say, but that's the historical record, and I'm sure this your book obviously goes into this, is very clear that, and a lot of people haven't sort of walked back from those comments in a way that, we still have people walking back from comments about race and the Civil War. Maybe that's another 40, 50 years we have to wait, but it's hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah, that's within our lifetimes. You're right. It was a form of dehumanization and very, state-run dehumanization that was central to the growth of the religious right that we saw during that period. And that's something that we could talk about, too, that the right, as we know it now, really sort of got its start with an anti-gay agenda in the late 70s and early 80s, and the federal response to AIDS was fuel for that.
You make sort of an interesting but perhaps controversial point in the book that in some cases, some of the nonprofits and health service organizations that sort of sprung up to confront the AIDS crisis sort of inadvertently strengthened some of those conservative arguments. How did you see that?
This is complicated, and it's something I've learned from others who have studied this. One of the themes I talk about in the book is sort of thinking about the strategies and tactics of social change as being organized around a focus on assimilation versus liberation, and this is something that many scholars of the LGBTQ movement use as a way to think about divides within the movement, and AIDS service organizations and AIDS activism in general is kind of a key example of this, that assimilationists tend to focus on the law and tend to focus on opening up existing American institutions for social change. Liberationists tend to see those laws as fundamentally broken and not able to be repaired, and they tend to focus on building alternative community institutions and on focusing on difference and celebrating that difference. And the AIDS movement, I think, complicates this in that AIDS service organizations, which came up very early on in the AIDS crisis as a response to the fact that the medical community and the federal government were just completely ignoring this crisis and people who were becoming ill, they came in to fill a gap, but they were private organizations, and that did sort of fit right into Ronald Reagan's view of how social service should happen. He thought that social service should be privatized and not really something that the federal government should be in the business of. And so while these AIDS service organizations were community-run organizations that were really community-controlled, they did sort of feed into this narrative at the time that was being pushed by Reagan that social care should be privatized.
And that's, we could have a number of separate shows on how that shows up over and over. What an excellent point. We're talking to Professor Lisa Stolberg, who's written, she's a professor at NYU, but she's written a book, LGBT Social Movements, and Professor Stolberg, when we talk about the 60s, 70s, that period, even the 80s, largely this was a gay and lesbian kind of movement. More recently, transgender, bisexual, these have become sort of other sort of newer attachments to what was a more fundamental movement historically. How is that sort of sorted out? Clearly, in the last number of years, transgender individuals have been, you know, wildly attacked in public policy. And we're seeing some of the worst now in North Carolina and Texas and other places, worst kind of legislation and public policy that we just talked about being so horrendous 30 or 40 years ago in terms of gays and lesbians. But what do we make of that? Are we really changing? I mean, are we winning? Are we losing? Where are we?
Whew, okay, well, that's a lot of questions rolled into one.
That's my bad. I don't know. I got too caught up in that question. You're so right. That was a bad question, but pick any part of that, and then I'll come back at the rest of it. Go ahead.
So I think just thinking about the diversity in the movement, so I think this is true of most social movements, that as they develop, they become more complex. And I think as we've seen the politics develop around gender and sexual diversity, we started out with gay being sort of the umbrella term that incorporated men and women. And then lesbians sort of fought for some gender inclusiveness and gender specificity, and the movement became known as the gay and lesbian movement. And then bisexual activists in the 70s and 80s started to fight for a complicating of the binary around sexuality, and so a recognition that sexuality didn't just have to be gay or straight, and that there could be diversity and complexity within sexual identity and sexual practice. And then transgender identity, so gay, lesbian, and bi identity have to do with sexuality. Transgender identity has to do with gender identity. And so it's a bit different, and we often lump the term together, and that makes it complicated, or it makes it so that we sometimes simplify something that is complicated. Gender identity, I think, is that we started to add this to the movement in the 1990s, and you're right, sort of bringing it up to the present. I think where we've seen some gains in LGB civil rights, like around marriage and around other civil rights for job protections, et cetera, I think transgender people have become the sort of new, I don't know what the right metaphor is, but scapegoat of the right, or target of the right, or target of the anti-LGBT politics of the time. And so we start to see, you mentioned this law in North Carolina and the law that was proposed in Texas that really targeted transgender people, and specifically their access to public facilities like bathrooms and locker rooms. And I think that that comes directly out of the fact that there have been these broader gains in civil rights and also acceptance for gender and sexual diversity in the country. And the right, and I'm sure we'll talk more about our current president, but you see that he's an example of somebody who goes to attacking transgender people as a way of shoring up a base when there has been some gain for LGBTQ rights in general.
The one of the problems of social movements is always how mass-based they are. And certainly whether we're talking about women's movements or civil rights, I mean, the larger the constituency, if you will, the harder it is to forever ignore their issues and rights. I mean, this is not a question. This is sort of, you know, part of the way I look at this as an organizer. And in that sense, I would have argued that the ability to make gains in the movement was directly influenced by the increase in public awareness. And as more and more people came out, if you will, and said, this is where I am, this is who I am, and very few families were left unaffected as that happened. And therefore, it's harder to, you know, demonize. And that's sort of a problem to the degree on the transgender side. It's not seen as large a constituency. I mean, it's and that I would think is a tactical and strategic problem in that part of the movement. Now, what's the question? You know, normally these are easier. I'm getting too caught up in this, Professor.
There's a lot to talk about.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, this is too much history and too much current events. I would think on the transgender rights side, that is going to be going to require a different strategy and tactics. Does that seem crazy, or is that what you're seeing as you look at the record and are looking at this as historically?
So, just to step back a little bit, I think, you know, to define the terms we're talking about. So generally, transgender is an umbrella term for anybody who identifies as a gender that doesn't match the sex they were assigned at birth. And that number is not, first of all, not that small, especially among young people. There was a recent study by GLAAD, which is an organization that works on media inclusion and cultural inclusion, that I believe the number is 12% of young adults identify as either gender or gender nonconforming, and this was a study that was done in just the last year. So that's not a small number. And I would also just say that gender is something, if we think about transgender identity as being something that has us have a conversation about what gender means, that's something that impacts all of us. I teach in a school of education at NYU, and we talk a lot about gender in the classroom and how teachers use gender or think about gender in the classroom, and that's a conversation that we can all have that does impact transgender experience and rights, but that is much broader than just the X percent of people who actually identify as transgender.
I know it was probably surprising to some people when we're transitioning now to more current terms, current times, as we're talking to Professor Stolberg, but the current controversy around transgender service in the armed forces. I mean, obviously, in the United States, we have a large military, but I don't know that some of our more conservative associates would have realized that we had, I think the figure I read in the Times was something like 15,000 plus transgender soldiers now who, you know, have been in the service, are performing competently, et cetera, who are impacted by part of President Trump's confusion on these issues. I mean, that's not a small number either. I mean, yes, the military is huge. It's not, you know, 12% of young people, as you just cited on that recent survey, but it's still something that is worth, it's not a, I don't mean in any way to say it's an insignificant number. This is a, you know, a huge issue for many people. But that's, you know, what do we do with an effort like we're seeing from Washington now to try to roll back so many of these rights, not only transgender might be in the first headline, but we're seeing that on the issues about health, you know, religious institutions being able to deny service and, you know, bakers and candlestick makers before the Supreme Court and all these issues. What are we going to do with this mess? Now, if you know that, everybody needs to buy this book. But how do we not at least vent for a minute?
Right. I think that Trump has really used his anti-LGBTQ, his willingness to try to legislate in a way that's very anti-LGBTQ as a way to shore up a base, and he's done that. We see time and time again that he's done that, especially in moments when he feels particularly under attack. So, you know, he announced this ban on transgender military service members via a series of tweets last summer. He brought it back up again just recently in the last month or so. I think we should be very worried about the way that the current administration, and I'd put Mike Pence at the center of this, has focused on the so-called religious freedom as a sort of backdoor into an anti-LGBTQ agenda. And the case you mentioned of this Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple That's currently before the Supreme Court. The Trump administration has weighed in on the side of the baker, on the side of religious liberty. I guess the one thing I would say that gives me a little bit of hope is that so far the court seemed to be checking him on this or checking his administration on this, and that he's had a number of court rulings that have not allowed him to institute this transgender military ban.
One was just very recent, the last week or so,
right.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, very recent.
The federal judge said, no. Hold on,
yeah.
Champ.
So we'll see. I mean, as he has the ability to stack the courts over time, we'll see how that changes. But so far, that does seem to be providing a check that the legislative branch is not right now. So we see that the Congress has been useless in checking him in many ways. But I think the courts so far have provided us a little bit of hope.
Well, and I don't want to put any sugar in a stiff drink, but, I mean, even the military itself has not seemed to embrace this new transgender bar.
Right, that's right.
We have a voluntary
military right now. So.
Yeah, and for many people, that might have been a surprise. They may have been assuming there was going to be a knee-jerk, we'll support, let's get rid of all these folks. But there's no shower, bathroom, whatever issues. We're not reading about that in military bases around the country or the world. I mean, this is something that's been part of, in a rare situation, the military has been able to absorb this. And they're not known for doing too well on these kinds of issues, are they, Professor? Maybe there is some hope for change there. Okay, so the courts, but we don't get to elect the courts. This religious freedom law is roundly opposed by most anyone, because where do you stop the ability to claim that for personal privilege you have the ability to deny fundamental rights of women, of African Americans, of gay, there's no... Once you say that you can say that you believe something, even though it's, drastically discriminatory and that's legal, I don't know where you stop that. So I guess that's my hope, that somehow common sense will, like a virus, spread somewhere important. But this has been, I don't want to take away from the fact that overall, as you look at social movement in this context of LGBT rights, we've seen huge accomplishments. So how are these movements preparing for this particular time? Do you have a sense of that?
I think it's by fighting on many fronts. So we've talked about the civil rights front, and there are a number of large LGBTQ legal organizations or organizations like the ACLU who have been very involved in litigating LGBTQ rights. So there's the legal side, and that's fighting for maintaining marriage equality. It's fighting for civil rights, so we still don't have federal laws that protect against job discrimination for LGBTQ people. So there are a lot of just kind of basic civil rights laws that are moving us forward and also just staying on defense. And then I think it's fighting on the cultural, too, for visibility and for inclusion. And that's something we haven't talked much about, but that's also a big front for social change.
There's hope. Professor Stilberg, tell people how they can get a copy of your book, LGBT Social Movements, or if they have any questions or follow-up for you. Is there any way to reach out?
Thanks. So anywhere books are sold, and a good way to find me is through New York University. I'm online there, and through Twitter, just at Lisa Stilberg. And I'd love to hear from folks.
Oh, my God, Twitter. Know, these days I'm afraid to even get near Twitter. So there's, brave people at NYU. And this is a book published by Polity, which is a UK publisher that does a number of very progressive titles, don't they? This is a good company you're in.
Yep.
I'm delighted.
They're wonderful.
This has been Professor Lisa Stolberg, LGBTQ social movements. In fact, I wasn't looking, didn't have my glasses on. Half the show, I probably left the Q out. Sorry about that. That's the correct title. Professor Stolberg says this is available anywhere in local bookstores and obviously online. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.